Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Okay, so let's unpack this deep dive into Louisa May Alcott's Little Women. It's much more than just a cherished children's story from 1868, isn't it? We're really looking at something foundational, something that kind of shifted the view on what young women could aim for in the 19th century.
Absolutely. And what makes Alcott's viewpoint so potent is her upbringing. I mean, she was completely steeped in this environment of social reform, especially transcendentalist ideas. You really need to grasp that. Transcendentalism wasn't just some abstract philosophy. It was, you know, a pretty radical way of thinking about individualism, morality, self-reliance.
Exactly. Her father, Bronson Alcott, he was all about experimental education, right? Mm. And her mother, Abigail May, a fierce advocate for women's rights. So you read Little Women, you're basically seeing that whole progressive intellectual household kind of distilled onto the page.
Mm-hmm. It gives the book its weight, its moral seriousness. And Alcott, you know, she wasn't writing from some sheltered life. She had real grit. Before the fame, she was a seamstress, a governess, and maybe most importantly, she served as a nurse during the Civil War. That experience must have been profound.
Definitely. And apparently, her publisher had to push her to write a book about girls. But she wasn't keen at first.
Right. But once she tapped into her own family, her sisters, she unlocked this remarkable authenticity. That's what critics called it. And it just resonated. Immediately.
Now, the timing was just perfect, too, wasn't it? Coming out right after the Civil War, society was already questioning things, thinking about women's education, their roles. Alcott's novel just smashed that old mold. Yeah. Suddenly you had young women characters with real flaws, big ambitions, dreams that went way beyond just, you know, finding a husband.
Yeah.
That characterization itself was revolutionary for the time.
So that sets the stage. Let's pinpoint the actual situation for you, the listener. We're in Concord, Massachusetts. The Civil War is raging. And the family, the marches, they're living in what the sources describe as genteel poverty.
Yeah, that term genteel poverty, it's so important.
Mm-hmm.
It means they weren't always poor. They had status, intellectual background, but Mr. March lost their money. So they're struggling, especially with him away serving as an army chaplain. It's a constant backdrop.
And it frames everything right from the opening scene. We meet the four sisters, Meg, Joe, Beth, and Amy, and of course, Marmee, their mother, who's like the family's ethical anchor. The book literally starts on Christmas Eve, 1862, and the girls are, well, they're complaining about having no presents because of the war and poverty.
Mm. And that complaint, it isn't just kids whining about gifts. It really sets up the whole novel's core theme, doesn't it? This journey from childhood selfishness to responsible adulthood, figuring out what it means to be a good woman in that specific time and place.
And they show their values almost immediately. That first impulse is to sacrifice their own little bit of Christmas money for Marmee. And then, even more tellingly, giving away their Christmas breakfast to the poor Hummel family. The home, the domestic space, is instantly shown as a place of real moral action.
Yes. It elevates the everyday. And right away, you see how differently the sisters handle their situation. Meg, the oldest, she just longs for luxury, feels the lack of it keenly. Joe is all fierce independence, chafing at limits.
Beth is the quiet one, gentle acceptance. And Amy, the youngest, she's focused on her art, but, well, vanity gets in her way quite a bit early on.
Let's maybe dig into each of them a bit more, starting with Joe March. She's clearly the main protagonist.
Oh, definitely Joe. She's the tomboy, the writer, really Alcott's stand-in, embodying that independent artistic spirit. Her story is partly about external success becoming a writer, but maybe more about her internal growth, learning patience, getting a handle on that fiery temper.
Self-control, yeah. That's huge for Joe. And then there's that decision, her marriage choice.
Ah, yes. Rejecting Lori, the charming, wealthy boy next door, for the older, rather poor Professor Bear.
That shocked readers then, and it still sparks debate now. But when you analyze it, it really fits Alcott's message, right? Joe chooses intellectual companionship, mutual respect, moral growth, mm-hmm. over just passion or money. It's about character.
Precisely. It underlines that theme. Now, Meg, the eldest, she wrestles with different things. Vanity, materialism, that whole desire for the finer things. She represents, maybe, the more traditional path. You see her tempted by her wealthy friends, the Moffats, and their lifestyle.
Right, but her arc is about seeing past that superficiality. She chooses love, marries the tutor John Brooke, who is good but not rich. She finds her own kind of dignity in embracing that conventional womanhood, as the sources put it. Alcott makes that path valid, too.
It's a deliberate choice, yeah. Then there's Beth, often called the spiritual heart, the little saint. So gentle, musical, but incredibly timid.
Her shyness is almost paralyzing, isn't it? It keeps her tied to the home.
It does. And her story arc is, well, it's deeply tied to sacrifice. She gets scarlet fever caring for the Hummel babies. Her illness becomes this central crisis point, this crucible for the whole family. It deepens their bonds, teaches them about loss and compassion in a really raw way.
Such a powerful part of the book.
Yeah.
And finally, Amy, the youngest.
Amy often gets a bad rap initially, you know. Seen as spoiled, vain.
Burning Joe's manuscript. That's hard to forgive early on.
Oh, absolutely. But her journey is maybe the most dramatic transformation. She grows from that petulant child into a really thoughtful young woman. She grapples with her artistic talent, realistically assessing her own limits.
That's such a mature realization, isn't it?
Yeah.
Accepting she might appreciate art deeply without being a true genius creator.
Yeah.
And that self-awareness allows her to develop this different, more mature relationship with Lori later on. They've both grown up.
Exactly. They meet on a different level. And we can't forget Marmee. The book is careful not to make her just a plaster saint.
No, that's key. She admits her own struggles, particularly with anger. She tells Joe she works on it every single day.
Right. And that makes her moral guidance so much more real, more relatable. She's not just preaching. She's living it, actively choosing kindness. That makes her lessons stick.
Okay, so plot-wise, things move along through their daily lives at first. Meg teaching, Joe working for Aunt March, secretly writing those sensational stories.
Amy's troubles at school, feeling ashamed of their poverty, that kind of thing. It establishes their world.
But the real shift, the catalyst for bigger change, is Lori, right? Theodore Lawrence showing up at that New Year's dance.
Absolutely. The wealthy neighbor's grandson. He brings friendship, fun, excitement, and inevitably romantic complications into their fairly contained world.
That new dynamic gets seriously tested when Mr. March gets ill in Washington.
Yes, Marmee has to rush off to care for him. Suddenly, the girls are forced to manage on their own, really step up.
And it's right then, during that crisis, that Beth gets sick.
It's the ultimate test of everything Marmee taught them. They have to pull together, face potential tragedy.
And they do get through it. The first volume, which was originally published separately, kind of resolves with a sense of forward movement.
Right. Meg gets married. Joe starts finding real success as a writer, though she faces that dilemma about compromising her art for money.
Amy finds her direction, even if it's not being a great artist. And Mr. March returns. Order restored. Hard work rewarded in a way.
Now, if we look under the surface at the bigger themes, moral education is just woven into everything.
Alcott was very intentional about linking the girls' struggles to John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. That wasn't accidental.
Not at all. The burdens they carry, Meg's vanity, is like Christian's burden, Joe's temper, Amy's selfishness. They're direct parallels.
So everyday domestic squabbles, like Meg overspending or Joe losing her temper, they're framed as significant spiritual tests.
Exactly. Your character is forged in the living room, essentially, which ties into that other major theme, the tension between individual ambition and family duty.
That's Joe's central conflict, isn't it? She wants literary fame, independence, but she also deeply values her family, the home.
Alcott explores that pull. She doesn't necessarily say one is better, but seeks a balance. Can you pursue your dreams and honor your responsibilities? The answer seems to be yes, if guided by morality.
And that leads to what was really quite radical for the time, this focus on domestic love and feminine influence.
Mm-hmm. The novel elevates the home, not as a prison, but as a sphere where real moral power resides. Alcott is making a case, implicitly, for women's moral and intellectual significance, even within the constraints they faced. Kindness, character, these are the weapons in life's important battles.
We also have to touch on economic class, that genteel poverty again.
Right. The March's richness in spirit and intellect is constantly contrasted with the shallow material values of wealthier families like the Moffats or the Kings.
The message is pretty clear. Character is more important than cash. Their struggles actually build their inner strength.
And Alcott's writing style really supports all this. It's that third-person omniscient voice, warm, guiding, sometimes directly instructing like a wise aunt. She uses symbolism beautifully, too. Beth's piano, signifying her pure spirit, Joe's attic as her space for ambition. Plus, lots of literary nods to authors like Dickens and Shakespeare.
The language itself is memorable. Think about some of those key quotes. Amy's line, "I am not afraid of storms, for I'm learning how to sail my ship." That just perfectly captures her growth, doesn't it? From being tossed about by her whims to actively navigating her life.
It really does. And Professor Bear's definition of love for Joe, It's less about swooning romance and more about deep, reliable commitment. Love alone is a beautiful thing, Joe, but there is something sweeter. It is to know that the heart we have won can rest assured in us and that we shall never betray its trust.
Wow. That really reframes love as moral trustworthiness, doesn't it? Mm. Enduring integrity over fleeting passion.
Exactly. And that deep moral core, combined with presenting young women as these complex, flawed, evolving people, that's why the book had such a lasting impact. It was revolutionary.
It inspired generations, changed perspectives on what girls could be and do.
And I think the emotional connection comes from how honestly it portrays just everyday life, the small wins, the disappointments, the family dynamics. It feels so real. You feel like you've actually lived alongside the March family by the end.
I think it endures because it shows us that the biggest human struggles, mm-hmm. the most profound journeys, often happen right there within the geography of the home, not always in grand adventures.
And by giving us four such different authentic paths to becoming a woman, Alcott showed that things like integrity, compassion, they can shine through in all kinds of dreams, whether you want to write books or create a loving home.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.